The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour on Cape Rays, and we're working our way through the Constitution and talking about a few of the issues and looking at the Constitution through the lens of Christianity. And when it comes to the Constitution, you know, the word God, G-O-D, is not in the Constitution anywhere, but that doesn't mean that God isn't there. God is throughout the Constitution. The concepts, you know, are inspired by the Ten Commandments, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and who and what God is. God is our king, our lawgiver, and our judge. That would be the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Of course, we don't have a king, we have a president. We have a separation of powers, we have checks and balances, we have a republic, or at least we're supposed to have a republic, in which there is multiple constituencies and multiple checks and powers to make sure that human nature and our tendency to move towards power and wealth and all of that is put in check. Of course, God doesn't have to worry about checks and balances, so he can be the king, and we're supposed to be obedient to our king, our lawgiver, and our judge. All right. So we're working our way through, and we are to Article 2, Section 1. We talked about natural-born citizen last week, and there's a section that's after that, that's in brackets. It's no longer applicable, but I'm going to read it. This is the way it originally was, and I want you to understand that things have been changed with the 12th Amendment, which we'll talk about in the near future. But here's what it says in the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, after the part about the natural-born citizen or citizen and be having to be 35, be president, and all that jazz. In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president. In other words, even then, if the president died or was unable to do the job, the duties would fall on the vice president, as it does today. The difference was, it didn't say that the vice president would become president. And so there were questions later about that. Then it says, and the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and vice president. Now, resignation, inability, something like that, inability. That opens up the opportunity for an opposing faction in Congress to, you know, have a mutiny to get rid of the president. And so the process has changed since then. Once again, why it's in the brackets. And that part of it has been changed by the 25th Amendment. Then it goes on to say, and both of the president and vice president declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act accordingly until the disability be removed or president shall be elected. Since then, the process of removing the president is a little bit more detailed and involves the vice president needing to be a part of it. In the case of disability, the president has to agree that he has a disability. If he doesn't, and the vice president and a certain number of people in the cabinet or appointed by Congress believe he does, then becomes a tug-of-war battle and eventually is chosen or decided upon, should I say, by the House of Representatives. So there have been changes since then, but we'll get into those when we get to them. So that's part of Article 2, Section 1. Let's continue. Then it says, the president shall at stated times receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. So you don't get a raise, you don't get a demotion in money, reduction in funds while you're president. They didn't want bribery and things like that. Hey, president, Congress here, if you do what we tell you to do, we'll give you a raise. No, it's not allowed. So the compensation, notice the word compensation is used, not emolument, not salary, compensation. You're serving the country. This is compensation for your service. George Washington didn't even believe that he should receive the amount of money they offered, so he refused it. Then they said, well, and the Constitution says you shall receive for your services a compensation. So he said, okay, fine, I'll take $1 a year. And that's what it was. President Trump did something similar. So the president shall at stated times receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within the period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. In other words, no federal money coming in from the federal government or the states. You know, the money you receive from the government is only that for you being president. You can't be double dipping and all that. Then it says, at the end of Article 2, Section 1, before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. So we must ask, what is the difference between an oath or affirmation? An oath would be to God, an affirmation is not. There were those religious sects of the time, that's S-E-C-T-S, sects, that believe that swearing to God was a sin. There were those that may not necessarily want to swear to God. And so, oath or affirmation. An oath is swearing to God. An affirmation is swearing based on your honesty that you're going to. Then it says, in quotes, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will do the best of my ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. End quote. Notice it does not say, "Do so help me God." That was added by George Washington. George Washington, after giving his oath, felt that he should add that. So he said, so help me God. And it's been a tradition ever since. Something else that happened with George Washington is when he originally was to be given the oath, he felt like he should put his hand on a Bible. There was no Bible present. That was not originally a part of the oath-giving process. They had not thought of that. They had not, you know, decided, oh gosh, you know, it ought to be a Bible. And so he asked for a Bible, and there was none present. So they went up the street to the nearest Masonic Lodge. That's Freemasonry, the Masonic Lodge, up the road to get a Bible. It's an interesting story. Now, I'm not going to get into Freemasonry in this episode, but in the future, in one of the future episodes, I will. Because there's a lot of conspiracy theories that have some truth to them, have no truth to them, a lot of truth to them. And I want to clear the air on that, but that'll be on a future episode. So that's the end of Article 2, Section 1. Now, I'm glad that we've gotten Article 2, Section 2, because it ties into something that's going on in the world right now. We're going to get to that. But Section 2 of Article 2 begins, "The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and the Militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States." Now stop right there. As commander-in-chief, that makes you the chief commander. You decide how the troops are deployed, how the units are deployed, and you know how they're going to respond to things, so on and so forth. You're commander-in-chief. That's your job. And so as commander-in-chief, being in charge of the armed forces, what does that mean? Does that mean you can go around just starting wars anytime you want? Well, the president does have the power to wage war. Congress has the power to declare war. But the attitude was not that we should offensively be using war for any reason as a country. You go back to the preamble, what does it say? Common defense. Article 1, Section 8, common defense. So our armed forces are not about being used on an offensive type of use, but a defensive type of use to protect the Union. Now that said, someone says, well, then how do you explain the Barbary Wars? Because Jefferson and Madison used the armed forces in those undeclared wars, by the way. They were not declared, which proves that, or shows us, because I think Madison and Jefferson understood the Constitution that the president can wage war without a declaration of war in place. It's still legal. But the war against the Barbary pirates seems offensive because we sent our troops there. We attacked them and all of that. But it was, in the minds of Jefferson and Madison, defensive, because what was happening was the Barbary pirates were attacking our vessels on our trade routes. They were taking our sailors as slaves, as sailors on their own sailing ships. And it was understood that war would happen. George Washington said that the best way to preserve the peace is to be prepared for war. Peace through strength. And that's a good way of looking at it. I believe we should be militarily strong, but we shouldn't be used in an offensive manner. And also, George Washington warned against foreign entanglements, that we should not get entangled in foreign wars unless they directly influence our interests. And so that was the attitude. And now we look at what's going on today. So we have what's going on in Ukraine, and what does the president do? You know, why is that happening in Ukraine? How should the United States respond to all of that? Well, we go back to Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Jefferson explained that no generation should have to pay the debt of a previous generation. So he was against a long-term national debt. And then he said that the only time that debt should really be created, that there should be a borrowing of money, is when there is war. Because war is an expense that goes above and beyond what you're normally spending. Otherwise, a country should be able to afford whatever it's taken care of. And in the case of the federal government, the authorities domestically were so small, they really didn't have to spend much money at all. But when a war happens, well, that's a sudden expenditure of money. Suddenly you've got to, you know, create more weapons of war as they're being used. You've got to, you know, pay the troops. You've got to, you know, get them to wherever they're going to go to fight, and so on and so forth. And so when you go to war, an expenditure of money increases. Now, in a system that was originally based on the Constitution, in which Congress was coining the money and regulating the value thereof, then that would mean that Congress would have to produce more funds, and that and if we borrowed some from someplace like Europe or something, we'd have to have good credit with them. And so that's kind of the attitude. But what if you have a system like the Federal Reserve, where you borrow money in order to have funds to use? That's good for the banks, isn't it? Let's back up there for a second. So the Bank of the United States, there were two of them in history, and now the Federal Reserve. They are private institutions. The Federal Reserve is not federal. The only thing federal about it is the fact that the word federal is in its name. And so in order to put money into circulation, we borrow it from the Federal Reserve, then we pay them back with interest. So now, whenever we utilize money, it creates debt. If there is war, we have a sudden need for more money, we have to borrow more, and then the banks lend more, and they get more interest. So, based on that, and based on what Jefferson was saying, where, you know, the only time you're going to need, you know, to go into debt would be for war, then whoever is providing the funds when you go into debt, they're going to make money when there's war. That is the central banking system. So the central banking system makes money, they do well, they get extra interest, all of that, when there is war. So if you are the private bankers out there, and understand, I'm not going into conspiracy theory land. This is conspiracy fact. Conspiracy factualist is what I am. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But when it comes to these things, the truth is, when there is war, certain factions, certain people, certain organizations, certain groups make money and power. The banks are one of them. Also, those who invest in weapons of war and things like that, they make money. Those who are involved in international politics and make money based on what's going on around the globe, they will prosper from it. So war, for these people who are going to make money, is a good thing. So I have a friend of mine, War Hamster, who says that all wars are banker wars. To a point, that is absolutely true, because it is the banking systems that are making extra money. They're doing well, and they may even be encouraging these wars. They may be behind some of it. I don't have all the details. I don't have all the evidence, all the proof, but on the surface, that's what it looks like. So now we have to ask ourselves about Ukraine. So the banks are happy. Putin is happy in the sense that while his economy is hurting, he's grabbing lands that he believes belongs to Russia. These provinces in the Ukraine that have separatist factions, they speak Russian. Then again, that was Nazi Germany's excuse for attacking countries. Well, there were German populations. They were trying to pull in under the umbrella. So it's the same kind of thinking. So how should the United States respond? Should the response of the United States be to get involved? Well, Ukraine is not technically a member of NATO, but they have a relationship with NATO. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it's a treaty. You're supposed to honor your treaties. So that puts the government in a very interesting situation. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. So the president's in charge here. He gets to decide, do I deploy the troops or not? And, of course, we don't want troops on the ground unless it's absolutely necessary. Of course, if Russian Federation, if Vladimir Putin's country decides to go beyond, they attack someone like Latvia or Estonia, who now is in NATO, then we would have good reason to. We got to honor our treaty. We're supposed to defend those countries. So it becomes a real sticky situation. But the question is, why? And I have my theories. Number one, war makes money. So everybody except for Ukraine has a benefit here. So everybody was probably in agreement. I wonder if they are in agreement. I wonder if they've been in touch with each other. I wonder. So then we have to ask ourselves this. We know that there are certain segments and factions of our government who've been dealing with some dirty stuff. And most of that dirty stuff goes through Ukraine. Ukraine is the most corrupt government in the world. Oh, Doug, we got to protect this democracy and those poor refugees and the poor people. I feel it. I feel for them. I recognize that it's not the people's fault. But in the Ukraine, the controlling factions that try to control it, it's like a bunch of little mafias. Different groups and families and all of this other stuff. And you've heard of Burisma and all that. And Igor, I can't remember his last name, who dealt with Hunter Biden. All of this is in play. And we have a very, very dirty country. So I'm not really sure if Putin is a good guy, bad guy, or something in between in this situation. Some of the stuff he's doing, bombing biological plants in Ukraine, you know, something like what's in Wuhan, China. That could be a good thing. Maybe, you know, he's getting rid of these bad biological weapons, it seems, on the surface, according to these reports. But is he really? Or is he covering up the tracks of those Americans or Russians that are involved in biological warfare plants in Ukraine? So, you know, you don't know. It's a good question. And I do know this, that Russia attacked the Crimean Peninsula during the Obama administration because he felt he could. During the Trump administration, Russia did nothing. Now, during the Biden administration, Ukraine is being attacked again. So we know that Putin feels that he can attack when a Democrat is in office. When President Trump was in office, he couldn't. Why? Is it because he was afraid of Trump, that Trump might use military retaliation, that Russia is not worried about the Democrats using? Perhaps. Or perhaps it's something else. Could it be that Putin, being a world leader, being on the world stage, has all the dirt on Obama and Biden, has all of their illegal activities that has been supposed, circumstantial evidence out there, some of it's real evidence. Putin has all of that dirt. He knows all of that information. Could it be that Putin is basically saying, hey, I'm going to do what I want when you guys are in office. And you can't do anything about it, because if you do, I'll spill the beans. I'll spill the beans and you'll go to jail. Could that possibly be the What's going on? And I've thought about this quite a bit, and I think that that might be a legitimate answer. Now, once again, I'm speculating. This is opinion, and I don't know for sure, but I do know for sure that Biden, as commander-in-chief, President Biden as commander-in-chief, can make this decision on whether or not to send troops or not, whether or not to send planes or not, whether or not to enforce a no-fly zone or not. I mean, he has those options. But I don't know if he's going to do it. I don't think he's going to do it because I think he's afraid. I think that Vladimir Putin is on the... He has the advantage here, and he's moving his pawns and his bishops and his knights across the chessboard in ways that President Biden and the Democrats are not sure how to respond. And the thing is, it should have been resolved before it even happened. Now, that said, one of the other things that's interesting to me is one of the sanctions, one of the ways to stop and hurt Russia, is they're shutting down the Russian natural gas pipeline, Nord 4, I think it's called, pipeline. So shutting down a pipeline then hurts a country. That's what they're saying by doing this. But they shut down the Keystone pipeline, and they said that was good. Well, if it hurts Russia to shut down their pipeline, doesn't it hurt America to shut down ours? So there's a contradiction there, isn't there? And I'm a firm believer that's very much the case. And I believe if we want to stop what's going on, all you do is the way Reagan did it. The way Reagan did it is he hurt their economy and he starved them of, you know, funding. How do you do that right now? What you do is you open up the Keystone Pipeline and you start drilling domestically again. You completely eliminate the world's need for Russian oil. You drill so much that not only does America become energy independent from Russia and the Middle East again, but that we have enough left over because we're drilling so much and we're producing so much that we're selling it to Europe. So Europe doesn't need Russian oil. Now, if Russia's making no money from their oil whatsoever because we wean Europe off of Russian oil, what happens? They've got no money. The invasion stops. That's what I think should happen. In fact, one other politician out there has voiced something similar to what I just said. Ted Cruz from Texas has said pretty much the same thing, and I think a few others have said something like that. So that's my thinking. Okay, let's get back on the Constitution. Sorry for that little sidestep there, but I felt it was important to talk about. So the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia in the several states when called in actual service of the United States. When is the military in the actual service of the United States? All times. When is the militia under the actual service of the United States, when they're called into the actual service by Congress? If you go back to Article 1, Section 8, it says that Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasion. So the militia needs to be called into actual service. When the militia is not called into the actual service of the United States, the president is not their commander-in-chief. The governor of that state is, because the militia belongs to the states. What do I mean when I say militia? We don't mean a bunch of good old boys up there with pickup trucks in Michigan. What we're talking about are the state militias. You know, remember, you know, when you read your history books about the war between the states or the American Revolution, right? You got these different militias that belong to the states. The Pennsylvania 12th or whatever. That's what the militias are. Now, when asked what a militia was after the Bill of Rights, George Mason said that the militia is the whole of the people and a few politicians. And if you look at Title 12 of the U.S. Code, it separates the militia into two parts, the organized militia and the unorganized militia. The organized militia is the state militia, the National Guard, the Naval Guard, the Air Guard, Naval militia, and there's a few others that are kind of listed in there. And then when it comes to the unorganized militia, that would be you and I. So whenever the militia is called into the actual service of the United States, the president becomes the commander-in-chief. He is not commander-in-chief when it is not under the actual service of the states. I mean, of the country, when it's under the states. Then the governor is the commander-in-chief. Okay, let's continue. Then it says he may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer of each in each of the executive departments. So in other words, the president doesn't know everything. And if he needs assistance, if he needs approval, if he needs advice, if he needs to be consulted on something, or he needs consultants, should I say, he needs to consult somebody for something, he may ask, and according to this, the principal officers of each of the executive departments, and they're to respond in writing. He asks in writing, they respond in writing. This is so that there's a record. The having a record was important to the founders. That's why I think it really killed them that the Library of Congress and the White House and a lot of the other federal buildings were burned down or burned to a crisp by the British during the War of 1812. I think it was like 1814 when the actual burning happened. So there's actually a lot of records we don't have because of that. Fortunately, there were copies of some of those records that were out there in other places. But records were important to the Founding Fathers, and they wanted stuff to be in writing so that there was a written record. So any advice that the president gets from his principal officers, from the departments, it's supposed to be in writing. Then it says, in writing of the principal officer of each executive department upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in the cases of impeachment. That means he can grant a pardon for anything except impeachment. Impeachment, once a president or a judge is impeached, sorry, Congress convicted you, nothing I can do about it. Everything else, if he wants to, he can pardon. He can pardon a murderer, he can pardon a burglar, he can pardon a political enemy or dissident or a turkey on Thanksgiving, whatever. So that is the first paragraph of Article 2, Section 2. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we will continue because we're going to get into the Senate's relationship with the president. Don't go anywhere.
Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation and cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth. Nothing more.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
If you are enjoying this program on K-Praise, Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, understand something. This is not all I do. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. I have written 7 books. I have 2 AM radio programs, one on Saturdays between 1 and 3 Pacific on KMET 1490 AM, and I have this one here on K-Praise. And then I have 3 YouTube channels. I have YouTube channels, the books, and 6 classes in Southern California on the U.S. Constitution. 2 in San Diego County, 2 in Orange County, 2 in Riverside County. Check out the classes page at PoliticalPistachio.com or DouglasVGibbs.com. And if you want to contact me, let me know you love the show. Let me know that you have a question, something like that. Feel free to email me at constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com. I appreciate you as a listener. I appreciate you as a reader. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you, constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, douglasvgibbs.com, and politicalpistachio.com. My books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Go to, once again, one of my websites to read which books you would like to buy at the books link. Once again, thank you for listening. Thanks again for being a part of the Mr. Constitution Hour. And God bless America, my friends. God bless you. The Constitution Association's website is at constitutionassociation.com. Constitution Association believes that the Constitution is the solution and the real hope for America. Be a hero in America's story. Make a difference. Protect, preserve, promote, restore the Constitution. Reclaim the Republic. Make America constitutional again. constitutionassociation.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back. Mr. Constitution, Douglas V. Gibbs here. This is K-Praise. You can learn more about me at douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Yeah, I have 8 books now out. Be sure to go to douglasvgibbs.com/store. Also, this radio program is funded by you, the listeners, and so if you want to donate, you can donate by going to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com, find the donate button, and donate there. That helps fund the program. The program has no advertisers, no sponsors. It is completely funded by you and my Constitution classes. And without those monies, the show does not exist. So if you would like this content to keep coming to you, then please feel free to donate. And I especially encourage monthly donors. So if you don't want to, say, send $100 or $500 or whatever, do $20 a month or $10 a month or $50 a month or whatever. I mean, if you donate $30 a month, that's only $1 a day. It's really not that much, but it really helps the program. The funding for the program, once again, comes completely from the listeners and the students in the Constitution classes. Without those monies, the Constitution show here, the Mr. Constitution Hour show here on K-Praise, ends. It stops. And so your participation is definitely an important thing. Okay. Once again, douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com, either one. Hit the donate button, and you can donate there. All right, it goes on in Article 2, Section 2, and we're going to get into the second paragraph of that section. It says, he shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. And it stopped right there. So Understand something. The delegates at the Constitutional Convention were there as representatives of their states. The states had sent delegates to create this Constitution and create the federal government. That makes the states the parents. They're the ones that created this through their delegates. So knowing that central governments, a federal government, a government of that size, that's for a government, for a country like this, in history has a tendency to become tyrannical, they wanted to make sure that they did everything they could to keep it from becoming tyrannical. And that included oversight over everything that the federal government did. So the states put in place their ability to provide oversight, to be a final okay for everything that the federal government did. And in the beginning, when the Constitution was being followed as originally intended, the federal government could not do anything without the state legislatures approving of it, giving their okay, at least directly or indirectly. Otherwise, couldn't be done. Federal government could not act alone without some type of oversight being involved. The oversight here is through treaties. Now, how is it that this means the states are given their oversight? Remember, the United States Senate, we talked about this in past episodes, was originally the populated by the voting in of the senators by the state legislatures. The state legislatures had their people in the U.S. Senate. The people, we the people, the population voted in the members of the House of Representatives. The people indirectly voted in the senators through the state legislature. It was the state legislatures who appointed the members of the U.S. Senate. It was a way for the state legislatures to have oversight over the lawmaking process at the federal level, as well as other things like treaties. So the president can negotiate a treaty all he wants. He can agree to it. He can okay it. He can sign it. He can do all the things that need to be done with the treaty. But the treaty is not in power. It is not effective. It is not in play until the Senate, with two-thirds vote, ratifies the treaty. Otherwise, it's not a treaty. This is one of the reasons why some presidents, and I can, President Obama did this with the Iran nuclear deal, and he called it an agreement. He says, well, it's an agreement. I don't have to get it ratified by the Senate. All agreements with other countries are treaties. It needs to be ratified by the Senate. This was a person who doesn't like the Constitution doing what he could to do an end around the Senate approval. The Senate is supposed to approve it. And the Senate, though, is supposed to be the voice of the states. It isn't anymore because of the 17th Amendment, 1913. So treaties have a certain danger about them. We'll get into that when we get to Article 6. But the president is not supposed to be making agreements with other countries without approval of the Senate. So he shall have power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States. So, once again, that oversight is in play here. He nominates, but he doesn't appoint. They're not appointed until the Senate approves the nomination. Well, I want this guy to be on the Supreme Court. Fine, but it doesn't happen until there's a confirmation hearing and the Senate agrees with you. You can nominate all you want, but the appointment doesn't happen until the U.S. Senate is in agreement. This is oversight by the states originally. Now that the 1913 17th Amendment has happened and the senators are voted in by the general public, that oversight by the states is gone. Then it goes on to say, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. So in other words, we're not talking about the basic jobs. We're talking about the department heads and judges and people like that. Those are the people who need to be nominated. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone. So what it's saying is that the inferior officers, let's say Secretary of State, it needs to be nominated. It's a major office. So, and Congress, or I'm sorry, the U.S. Senate needs to confirm that appointment with a confirmation hearing and approval. But they may say, okay, but everybody under the Secretary of State, the assistant, and all this other stuff, president can choose those people without it having to go through the whole process. The inferior officers. That's what it's saying. So I'll reread it just so you understand now. For what shall be established by law, but the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the present alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. So once again, the staff that's underneath the Congress can choose, I'm sorry, the Senate can choose, well, Congress actually can, that the president can do that without having to go through that process, Congress meaning both houses. The president then shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. That is that recess appointments. That's what that is. And so if the Senate is on recess, there's nobody there to confirm. There's nobody there to approve. And if a seat needs to be filled, what does the president do? He can do what's called a recess appointment. He can say, okay, this person is going to hold that spot until the Senate comes back into play, and then they can decide whether or not to keep that person or not. And then at the end of their next session, it would expire if they don't make that decision, and the seat's empty again. So recess appointment. So now, what if you want to go on recess, you want to go on vacation, but you don't trust the president? You don't want him to have that power of recess appointments. What do? You go into what's called a pro forma session. A pro forma session is a session in which there are less people than the quorum. In other words, you can't do business, but you're still in session because there's still people there. You don't end the session, he can't do recess appointments. But if they don't have a quorum, they cannot do a confirmation hearing. So it has to wait until there's enough people in Senate to confirm the appointment or the nomination. Then it says, in Section 3, Article 2, Section 3, he shall from time to time give to Congress information of the State of the Union. I remember hearing, President Ford, and he says, the State of the Union is in bad shape. That was how he started his speech. But State of the Union, so it says he shall from time to time give to Congress information of the State of the Union. He shall. Shall means it's mandatory. Has to be done. Recent State of the Union speech was not received so well by the opposition. The opposition typically doesn't receive well the State of the Union speech by a president of an opposing faction. But he shall do it. It's a requirement. So he shall from time to time give the Congress the information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. Notice he can recommend what they do. He cannot make them do it. The president is not a ruler. The president is not a king. The president is not a legislator. He cannot legislate either. He can recommend to Congress saying, hey, I'd really like to see this happen. And Congress can say, well, all right, good idea, but no. And that's the end of it. So the president, while he can recommend, he cannot make them do anything. So, recommend to their consideration such measures he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, what's an extraordinary occasion? Outside the norm, it's above normal, it's crazy, what's going on, there's a war going on, something like that, extraordinary occasion. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them. So in other words, they're saying, hey, we're on vacation, hey, we got a war, I need you here. Or we've got this emergency. I need you here. I am calling for you to convene. He can do that. And in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. So in other words, if it's just getting so bad, there's the disagreement so getting so bad, I mean, we're worried someone's going to get shot or something, he can say, you know what, guys? You're adjourned. Take a break. Go to the pub. Figure it out, go home for a while, relax, let's get our heads straight, and then we'll come back together and work on this later. President can do that. All right, then it says, he shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He is the figurehead. He is the head of the country on the surface. So he's going to do those duties that a king or queen would do, that a ruler would do in the sense of receiving ambassadors, receiving dignitaries, you know, having a dinner at the White House, all of that jazz. That's the job of the president. Now, remember, technically, the president is not a ruler. He's not totally the head, can't do anything without Congress and all that jazz. But when it comes to receiving other leaders, he is going to act in that role. Then it says, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So the laws have to be faithfully executed. He can't say, you know what, I don't like that law, I'm not going to execute it. It doesn't say that. It says he shall, it's mandatory, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. For example, immigration law. The president is supposed to execute immigration law as it is on the law books. He can't say, well, you know, I don't like the way it is, so I'm only going to execute a part of it. No, doesn't have that option. He shall, mandatory, take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. So if someone is receiving a commission, they're an officer, and it doesn't necessarily mean military officers, although it includes that. It could be other officers, other office holders in the government, and so on and so forth. Article 2, Section 4, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. All right, so it's saying that the punishment for violating these things, treason, bribery, high crimes, misdemeanors, and misdemeanors, all of that requires removal from office if they're impeached and they are convicted. Upon conviction, they are to be removed from office. That is to be the punishment. That means that in impeachment, it can be a different punishment. But in the case of the president and the vice president, you can only be removed from office because, listen carefully, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. What's a high crime? And people would say, well, high crime's like murder or bribery. Or no, high crime is a crime committed by a person high in office. That's a high crime. So any crime and any misdemeanor by the president while in office is a high crime or misdemeanor. So in other words, the president and the vice president can be removed from office for anything that's criminal. But bribery and treason being the most, you know, the worst, I guess you could say, most egregious, and so they can be removed for that, but they can be removed for anything. But the impeachment has to go through the full process. So the House of Representatives brings up the articles of impeachment and says, hey, this is what we think is wrong. Here's the articles of impeachment. But the court for impeachment, because it's a political trial, it's not a criminal trial. It's a political trial, so the court is not a court of law with a judge and all that. The court is the Senate. But the person holding the gavel, the judge that's in charge, won't be the vice president, president of the Senate, because that's a conflict. And so the Chief Justice of the United States would then wield the gavel and preside over such a trial. So we have a situation where the president has done something, bribery, treason, high crimes, misdemeanor whatsoever, and so then the House of Representatives, which is the voice of the people, remember originally, says, hey, broke the law, not good, needs to be removed. We are charging the president with these charges. Then the impeachment, and that means you've been impeached. Impeached does not mean removed from office. But the if convicted, according to this last clause that we just read, if you're president or vice president and you're convicted, you must be removed from office no matter what it is, be it treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So the House says, hey, we're charging, we're upset, we got a problem here, we think he's guilty of this, here you go, Senate, hold the hearing. Senate then holds the hearing. Now remember, the Senate is supposed to originally be the voice of the states, not the voice of the people. It's not supposed to be people voted in by the population. They're supposed to be people appointed by the state legislatures. They're higher in political, you know, stature. They're more politically savvy, whatever. And so they're the ones that hold the hearing. If they convict the president, which no president has ever been convicted, there's been 4 impeachments, Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and twice on President Trump, but in all cases, they were acquitted. There were not enough votes from the Senate to convict the president. In the case of Andrew Johnson, he stayed in his presidency by 1 vote. one vote kept him in office. Now, this idea is actually very biblical, because remember, justice is very biblical. Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice in court, you shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. So even if they're a holder of office, a president, there needs to be justice. The interesting thing is, in Article 3, it also goes into how even for treason, there needs to be two witnesses. And when you go to the Bible, same thing is in place. 1 Timothy 5:19, do not admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. And then we've got 2 Corinthians 13:1, this is the third time I am coming to you. Every charge must be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. So they didn't want justice, the Bible didn't want justice to be taken lightly. There must be a process, and it must be taken very seriously. There needs to be two witnesses, and you don't mess around with it. So the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for or in conviction of. So it needs to be the process, or has to be the conviction. Treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. So that's Article 2. We're done. And I appreciate you spending the time with me. We'll get on Article 3 next week. We'll talk about the judicial branch. Until then, I want to say this. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. Appreciate all that you are, all that who you are. Thank you for the prayers. Thank you for the help of keeping this show on the air. And we'll see you next week here on K-Praise. Mr. Constitution Hour, Douglas V. Gibbs. God bless. We'll see you then. Thank you for listening to the program. And let me remind you that once again, as I stated earlier in the show, that each week this program comes to you because of funding from folks like you. If you want to help keep this program on the air, please feel free to contribute to the effort. It could take $10 a month, $20 a month, or a large gift at one time, however you want to do it. But the program, in order to stay on the air, requires help from the listeners. I do not have advertisers. I do not have sponsors. I conduct Constitution classes throughout Southern California, six classes, with gas prices going sky high. That's getting hard to even have enough money left over the program. But so the program really requires you. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com, DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. Hit the donate link.
J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.